Welcome to A Hot Topic, addressing heat vulnerability in the Capital Regional District, also known as the CRD. Thank you for being here. I am your host, Erica Dolman, a researcher, equity advocate, and resident of Victoria, located in the CRD, in British Columbia, or BC, Canada. Before we begin, it is important to acknowledge the land on which this podcast was recorded and produced. We, as a research team, acknowledge and respect the Lekwungen, the Songhees and Sepsum or Esquimalt peoples, on whose territory the University of Victoria stands, and the Lekwungen and Wasanich peoples whose historical relationships with the land continue to this day. I live and work on this unceded and stolen territory. I think of how some people may not consider their relation to the land until they experience a threat to their proximate environment, like an extreme heat event. As I work, play, and live on this land, I sometimes feel struck as a white settler by how much I take from the land without considering my place on it and how to take care of it. With this self-awareness and curiosity, I practice being present as much as I can, approaching people and life with patience, listening, expressing gratitude for the land I live on and other land that I do and will visit, and by engaging in efforts to integrate Indigenous ways of being and knowing into my community by prioritizing relationships, having respect for all living things, understanding the cyclical nature of knowledge, and remembering the value of traditional knowledge passed down through generations. As I recently finished my master's thesis, which centered on the importance of connection between one another during extreme heat events, this project cannot be shared without an understanding, acknowledgement, and appreciation of the land on which extreme weather events occur, and the encouragement to turn to each other when the next one comes. Though this research discusses the geographical area of the CRD as its frame of reference, I want to highlight that extreme weather events are experienced worldwide because of climate change and extend and affect beyond the constraints of borders. My first interview was conducted with Eva Schaefer, member and marine liaison of Sauk Nation. She invited me to her home on Sauk Nation on a sunny summer morning. Not a cloud in the sky and no wind. I'd driven through the town of Sauk many times, but had never been to Sauk Nation. I had a feeling of apprehension as I turned down her road, amplified when I initially couldn't find her house. When I drove in, there was a single gravel driveway on the left, but otherwise tall trees surrounded the area. I had to pull over and reread our email exchange to verify where exactly her house was. Turns out, it was the single driveway I'd driven past on my way in. Her two-story home independently stood with trees and nature surrounding it, sort of like a clearing in the woods. There were no other structures in sight. The air was crisp, and I could tell that later on it'd be a hot day. I got out of my car and looked up at her house. As the morning sun shone on it, Eva's head popped out of a second-story window. She greeted me and invited me to come in through the main floor entryway. This immediately eased my apprehension, and I felt welcomed into her home. She answered the door, and we walked through the main level of her home and then upstairs to her kitchen. She offered me a hot beverage, and we chatted a bit before we began the interview. It's amazing how grounding it is to be offered a hot beverage upon arrival in an unfamiliar environment. I sighed a breath of relief and settled into her space. There was a sliding door open onto the trees, and birds could be heard chirping and rustling in the leaves. We sat at her kitchen table and eased into our conversation. So, let's just take a look here at the levels. Let's see. Okay, could you just say, tell me your name and your work or kind of community work and your affiliation or experience with extreme heat.
All right, so my name is Eva Schaefer. I'm a member of Sauk First Nation, and I have been working on the marine team here since late 2020. That's when I started as a marine liaison officer, and the role gradually grew as more and more programs came our way and more engagement from people interested in traditional knowledge and Indigenous way of knowing and how to steward our territory. all the hats started piling up, and now I mainly do communications, so now I'm here talking to you on our program and our experiences with extreme heat in the community.
Awesome.
So that's me.
Yeah, no, that's great. And so we're kind of talking about all heat events that have happened since the 2021 heat dome, but kind of trying to connect back to that time of the 2021 heat dome.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to be kind of more discussing that. So how did the 2021 heat dome affect you and your community?
So at the time, South Nation is kind of in a very special little geographic zone where we are frequently in the middle of summer a good 5 degrees cooler than our surrounding communities. You can drive 10 minutes and again, the temperature will just raise, it'll be warmer, it'll be drier. So while we did experience the heat, our community, I think, felt less of an impact than our neighboring communities. So again, just 15, 20 minute canoe trip up the coast, and our cousins were losing all of their clam beds.
Mm-hmm.
We were a little bit more protected there and were able to actually provide food fisheries for our neighbors in that time, but we definitely saw impacts. A lot of our terrestrial food species and trees and things like that saw a lot of stress. Our forested areas and our traditional territory are actually privately held, and the stress on a lot of the young, recently planted trees was too much after, well, I'm gonna say a good century of mismanagement. They didn't have that versatility, that strength in a strong ecosystem to fall back on. So they all dried out and died. We definitely saw a lot of that. We've never really been concerned about fire in our territory until recently. So that summer really kicked off a big interest in getting into our traditional territory, which again is privately held. It's some of the only privately held forest land in Canada, to get in and start managing it, or at least doing the research on what management needs to be done, and just get eyes on the ground, get inventory of what that space looks like now. So that was the 2020 like point in time when that happened, when we're like, oh geez, like it's been getting worse and now it's bad.
Yeah.
It's never not cooled off overnight here in my living memory.
Mm-hmm.
We're right on the ocean. We call August foggus because it's so chilly and damp, and it was warm all the way through halfway through August. We still had that fog bed come in the morning, but it would burn off by the afternoon, and that was unusual.
Mm-hmm.
So like our shellfish survived, but we definitely saw a lot of stress in the territory, and a lot of our berry species didn't come out that year. And the next year there was a strong impact on our harvest, our forage harvests.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, definitely impact. It's not like we weren't influenced by it, although I will say that it wasn't as bad as I saw some of our cousins deal with.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And so during that time you were here on South Nation, correct?
Yes, so I was working for the Nation at that point. We were doing a lot of marine work. It was actually pretty nice because it was frequently hot enough to take the boat out really far and then spend the whole day out there and not get too chilly. But yeah, working in fisheries and marine, and in the marine space and rehabilitation remediation, that was actually when we started doing a lot of our measurements, our baseline measurements.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of concerning to me, is for years we've been pushing to better understand just how much work we need to do in our territory once we get it back after modern treaty comes through and we have more access and authority in our land, just understanding what's there to clean up. With all of the Truth and Reconciliation funding that came through, we were finally able to start up these programs, and we started measuring in 2020 during the heat dome. So I'm like, this isn't a really great time to be catching a baseline measurement.
Mm-hmm.
We really should have been able to do this before now. So yeah, it was interesting for me as a scientist to be like, are we sure we need to get this done, but is this the right time? when it's a anomalous,
yes,
quote unquote weather event. So
yeah, absolutely. And so during that time, how did you respond to the heat dome, and how has your behavior changed since that last heat dome?
I love the heat. I'm like a lizard. I like it when it's hot out.
Yeah.
Everybody else was losing their mind as soon as it got above like 25,
yeah.
26. I'm like, this is great. I wouldn't say personally my behavior has changed. I've always had an interest in climate change. It didn't change my mind about anything. It didn't make me want to do better because I have been haranguing people about this for years, and it kind of was almost vindicating. Like, you can't argue against climate change now, and people still will, but it's like, all of my aunties and uncles that have a hard time grasping that concept really understood when the heat dome happened that this was something way outside their living memory.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were knock-on effects because it was so dry and hot all summer that our rivers didn't get enough water. And we didn't get the rains until late November, at which point we had the atmospheric river, which was a direct, I believe, result of that heat dome. I don't know as much about weather science as a climatologist would, but I have the feeling they're interconnected.
Yes.
So our salmon run that year was awful. The eggs that were in the river during the heat dome didn't get enough shade. The water got too shallow. They perished. The rivers were too low. The salmon couldn't get up. The few that were able to make it up and lay eggs, and I think our count that year was maybe 10 fish up the Souk River. Because again, when there's stressors like that, we also get predators, more predators in the basin. They come in and they eat the fish as they come up the river because they've been having a hard time hunting everywhere else and they know where to go.
Mm-hmm.
We basically didn't have a run that year. Because again, the 10 fish that were able to make it up, any eggs that were laid were either buried or washed away when the rains hit, and we got a month of rain in 24 hours.
Yeah.
And then we had both the coldest and warmest day in December. that like winter day that we've ever had. It was just such a nuts year for temperature and like that fallout.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we've kind of been seeing these cycles ramp up more and more and more. So definitely it was quite alarming for, I think, a lot of people in the territory and the community to actually maybe have to come to terms with the fact that, hey, this is real and we actually need to do something now.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess maybe in some ways I've become more smug. Maybe my behavior has changed in that way. Like, oh, I told you so. What did I tell you?
Yeah, definitely. And so how would you say that the extreme heat has affected your mental, physical, and emotional health and well-being? So I know you've discussed a lot about the land and how this is, of course, interconnected, but as a person and your mental, physical, and emotional health, how would you say has that been affected by these events?
I mean, for me, physically, I get outside more and do more hiking when it's hot, so that's nice. I get to swim. But emotionally, mentally, spiritually, it's very hard to watch. It's difficult to maintain optimism, especially, again, like, I've been interested in climate change since I was a child, back in the mid-90s.
Mm-hmm.
I went to school for natural resource conservation at UBC, and I was doing this work in 2004, and I had professors telling us this was an important thing to care about. And at that time, naively, I thought everybody was on board. I thought everybody knew there'd be maybe some vocal minority that was guided by capitalistic principles and industry to lie about it, and we just need to get the scientists into policy places. But I graduated in 2009, which was just after Harper had essentially muzzled all of the scientists. We could no longer talk about climate change. All of the funding was taken away from all of these programs. So I've struggled with depression quite a lot since the early 2010s, just knowing that we needed to be doing something about it and watching it get worse and worse and worse as the years progressed. Having the IPCC goals of whatever from the early 90s their worst case scenarios were met and surpassed in like the mid 2015, 2016 times. And it almost got to the point where it's like, hey, if we're yelling any louder, we're gonna deafen them. They're already not listening. They think we're hysterical. To see us reach this point, and I don't wanna say it's a point of no return because it makes my life's work moot, essentially. I mean, like, for me, maintaining optimism means doing the work and, like, trying to make incremental change where I can.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to see how, if we can't fix it, how can we adapt to it? Maybe we bring in species from warmer areas that are used to their beaches boiling every year kind of thing. Maybe we have to be more flexible with how we look at things.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause a lot of the indigenous species in this area aren't cut out for the projected change in climatic zones, biogeoclimatic zones. So I'm trying to maintain optimistic. I'm trying to find the good news stories. I'm trying to work on these things. I'm trying not to be too smug about it. I told you so.
Yeah.
And yeah, I do struggle with that kind of depression of like, they don't care. The people in charge don't care. Even when they say they care, I work with
mm-hmm.
the government. I see how it, I hesitate to say functions, but I see how it operates.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just frustrating. I mean, we can hold meeting after meeting after meeting and round table after round table after round table just to decide if we should even begin to discuss if this is a problem. And then it's, well, we can't step on anybody's toes, so we can't do anything about it. And it's frustrating. It's
mm-hmm.
depressing. It can be very anxiety-producing when, like, really bad weather is coming up. And we're like, well, is it going to be worse than we expected? What if all the power goes out? What if the island gets isolated? We only have enough food for 10 days. Like,
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of concerns, because I've also done emergency management. Like, what happens if the highway gets shut off? What if there's a fire? Souk is super isolated. South Nation even more so. There's all of these concerns that come into play that a lot of people don't think about when it comes to extreme weather events.
Mm-hmm.
Like heat events, people were dying because they weren't used to how much water they needed to drink, like.
Yeah.
So a lot of it's just community preparedness, like trying to get
yeah.
the word out there, trying to spread the good news stories and work on the bad, and
yeah.
it's really all you can do, and try not to let it get you too sad.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess that's the ultimate thing, is just keeping your head up as much as you can with those good news stories.
Yeah, definitely develop something of a gallows humor.
Yeah,
the whole thing.
Yeah. Honestly, I agree with that.
Yeah.
So you've kind of alluded to this, but what are some of the barriers you experienced during the heat dome of 2021 or those around you?
That's a good question. Barriers. Again, I think it's just the communication.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to talk about it in such a way that lets people listen without having them shut down, because it is a very big problem. And I think people shut down when they're approached with big problems as a coping mechanism, because there's so much anxiety inherent in not having control over your environment and the world around you,
mm-hmm.
which I think we as humans have the arrogance to believe for thousands of years. We've had that mindset of, this is our land, we are the stewards, we can take what we need, and it's big enough. And, you know, we can fight each other for it instead of working together to make it better. That arrogance feeds into that anxiety, because that lack of control, I think, scares a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
So the barrier is, how do you communicate it in such a way that doesn't scare people, because we don't really have any answers, and encourages us to continue working together towards a solution, because that is the solution, is a group effort to fixing things. But unfortunately, we see again and again and again in history is that when those anxieties start up, people shut down and they become increasingly insular to their in-group and protective of the things that they have, and I guess a little more bellicose. And I think that's what we're seeing a lot of in the world with the rise in more conservative, hard right, fascist politics, is that anxiety and that fear, and people really not having an answer. So the answer is, this doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you talk about it, the more you scare them, and it becomes, they shut down further and further and further into that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, the biggest barrier, I think, is just communication.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so, and what were some resources or tools that you used to cope with the extreme heat, or those around you? And were there any government resources you used during the heat dome of 2021, or was it mostly resources?
As a nation, I believe, and I don't know what we received. I know that we had funding separately, and kind of ironically, from the TMX pipeline expansion project for the Oceans Protection Plan, and we were using that to measure and assess what was actually going on. So we have sensor buoys out in the harbor and basin that measure temperature, wind, wake, wave, temperature, salinity, and there's one more. And it was interesting to see those profiles change and just be able to kind of grasp further, like, okay, now we have pictures to show people the impact. Like,
mm-hmm.
yeah, you felt the heat, but, like, here's what actually happened.
Yeah.
But, no, I wouldn't say that I had any special tools or was provided anything aside from having previously lived in Vegas and really enjoying the heat. Yeah.
I feel like your perspective is definitely unique, having been a lizard, as you said.
Yeah.
So, and so we've discussed this a bit in terms of just how much this has affected your community, but how has it changed the community, these extreme heat events? How has it kind of altered the community?
I'd say the biggest thing, and this is something that we've been experiencing for years, but these recent events were kind of the icing on the cake or the straw that broke the camel's back, is the loss of our food. We wouldn't have salmon in the ocean around here if we weren't working with the hatcheries. We don't have a lot of our traditional berries or medicines or anything available any longer, just because the ecosystem wasn't diverse and robust enough to maintain through those events. So, well, yeah, you know, they could kind of get by with logging and people spraying them with pesticides and overgrazing from animals that have lost their habitat and now their only food is our food. Things like that. This kind of sort of tied that all together, and now a lot of that stuff is gone. Their refuses and their little areas and pockets in which they were able to survive, we don't have those anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm actually interested to try to start a community forest that is built around the concept of sustainable food management as we used to know it. I'd be interested to, I think it spurred some government interest in maybe forest and silviculture management, so like controlled burns and thinnings and things that are proven to, and like diverse species planting, things that would mimic a proper coastal ecosystem as opposed to the plantation we have up in our traditional territory now. Because there's big concern now. There's concern now from the government level that it'll burn. And because that impacts their bottom line as a forestry, well, fucking 40% forestry based, I think BC is. Because that impacts the bottom line and it scares industry, they'll finally do something about it. Of course, they really want us to do something about it. They're like, here, have your land back. Like, now that it's a giant tinder pile and we can't get any more value out of it and there's no more food left in it for you. Yeah, so it kind of spurred that interest, I think, and on all levels, federal, provincial, local government, and then our nation's government as well. So it's interesting to see that these extreme weather events seem to be, because they are impacting bottom lines and because they are impacting industry, suddenly, oh no, who could have guessed? And okay, now local community, solve it. And like, but don't impact industry too much. Like, so like, it feels like too little too late, but it's nice to see that that locomotive is just beginning to gain ahead of the steam, I think.
Absolutely, yeah. And so you actually just kind of, this is a perfect segue into the next question, but how could municipal, provincial, and federal government and service providers better communicate with the community about extreme heat events? You kind of discuss things that could be, or that are happening, but how do you think the communication could be improved?
Well, it's interesting, because when you were telling people the truth 15, 20 years ago, you got accused of being alarmist and fear-mongering. And like, even when we underplayed what was going to happen for fear of, like I mentioned, causing people to panic and close down, it's a really, like, I don't know the answer to that question. I've been trying to figure that out for the last 15, 20 years. I wish I could talk to people in the way I understanding things and have them get it, but they don't. So I've been kind of, I mean, I think the best governments can do is just prepare their infrastructure realistically. And that can be hard because a lot of the tax dollars aren't there, or the funding, or what have you. I'm not sure you can do much for the public because the people that are already listening are already there.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like we've almost been polarized, not to the same degree as our cousins down south, but it's almost like we picked a team and then some people are like, oh, climate change exists, and other people aren't, and it's more of a fight. Gosh, what do they call that? Anyway, yeah, I don't envy government their job. I mean, it is my job for my community, but my community is much more connected to the land. So they don't really see the fallout, or I guess off the reservation, they don't really see the fallout, whereas we are out on the water, we're out in the bush, we are harvesting, we're hunting, we're fishing, we're doing all these things, and as a community, a lot of the time, we're bringing our kids out to go crab raking, we're going clamming, we're revitalizing a lot of our traditional activities. Almost, again, too late to even teach them what the forest used to look like. I think just keeping people as informed as possible about, hey, it's going to be this hot this summer, like, be prepared in XYZ way. It's going to be stupidly rainy or weird this winter, be prepared in XYZ way. Hey, we're going to get snow for a week. I know that never happens, but be prepared, because everybody's pipes were bursting after the heat dome. It was crazy. Our houses aren't built for these extremes. And that's another thing, is we're gonna need a big influx and investment in housing. I mean, honestly, I think that's the best government can do, is really start investing in high density walkable housing, that it lessens our reliance upon cars and transit and all of these things. It makes the solutions a lot more palatable to people. Like, if you threaten to take someone's truck away, and that's what they hear when you're like, okay, climate change is an issue, like, well, what about my truck? And you're like, okay, well, that's like, it gets really personal for them. But like, you can't phrase it like that, and that is, I think, the mistake the government made, and I think they did it on purpose, was to offload the responsibility from industry and from themselves onto consumers. So it's like, oh, your carbon footprint. So now when you try to approach things to a more conservative person who perhaps doesn't believe it, all they hear is the things you want to take away from them, not the things that you can provide. And I'm not sure it's so much of a conspiracy theory, but I read that the whole carbon footprint concept was invented by the oil industry and by corporations to offload that blame of what's being generated and pumped into the environment onto the consumer. And realistically, yes, they're making things for us, but they never stopped and questioned, does this thing really need to be made? And government never stopped to question, hey, maybe we don't need a billion plastic trinkets, maybe we should be trying to invest in value-add industries or something that actually grows our communities, or things I think what government can really do, what communities can really do, is create sustainable, healthy communities, not divide us with more of a capitalistic mindset where it's fuck you got mine, everybody's looking after themselves, everybody needs to drive their own truck, everybody needs their own giant house, everybody needs to, I mean, not that I can but you know, things like that, where it's government, the only thing government can do is change their policy motives, and they're not going to do that, not without some pushing.
Yeah, and I, like you said earlier, not until baseline is
not
affected,
until bottom
their bottom line
impacted.
Is affected, exactly. So, in terms of kind of the community perspective in during extreme heat events, what types of community support do you think would be useful during extreme heat events?
I mean, for my community particularly, it would be making sure the elders are looked after. People that maybe don't have air conditioning or access to healthy water, clean water, cool spaces, isolation. Like, all of these things cause problems for our elders when there's extreme heat events. So I think just outreach, and like, I mean, like, real outreach, like, particularly in our community, we have like 130 people living around here, door to door, make sure people are doing okay, see what they've got, what they need. I mean, we already do that with our food baskets and things like that. Just include maybe literature on ways to keep cool, things like that. Mm-hmm. I don't really know the answer to these things, because it's community outreach is actually a really difficult thing to do. Like, especially when people are kind of living paycheck to paycheck and hand to mouth, is they're too busy surviving to really manage and anticipate, or even if they know it's coming, to deal with it. So resources in that sense, again, I think a lot of it goes back to affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
Great way to deal with extreme heat stress. If we all had small air-conditioned apartment buildings for people that need them, like, like, we don't have homeless people dying on the street, we don't have our elders in a trailer boiling to death, like, things like that. It's all infrastructure based. I think a lot of it is going to be developing the infrastructure with change in mind, not building for 10 years ago, but building for what we assume 20 years from now is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, even if it isn't as bad as we assume, we still made a better place to live for everybody. Like, us, like, oh no, and everybody has a house. Like,
totally.
There's a lot of these sort of more, I think, community-based infrastructure development, step outside of this hyper-capitalistic, car-driven culture, and begin to reassess smaller, more walkable, more sustainable lives with access to nature, so that people have the time and the means to get out and actually appreciate it, enjoy it, and understand what we're losing.
Because
I think that's a really sad thing, is, like, a lot of people don't see that change. They don't understand what we're losing, and there isn't that, like, process to get them kind of interacting with what their activities are impacting.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's just so many so many things to consider, but infrastructurally, it's interesting to think about how integral that'll be. And thinking of particularly the city of Victoria and how almost every building is ancient, or a brand new condo that's just been propped up that might be, well,
like
it's likely
condo 2.0.
Exactly. Yeah. It's completely unaffordable, right? So it's just, you know, it's a challenging thing with lots of money, for sure. Well, that actually brings me to the end of my designated questions here, but do you think there's anything else I should have asked about but didn't, or any gaps or comments or thoughts in terms of kind of, or even just extra thoughts that you have to add on at all?
I don't know. I really hope there's something that we can do.
Yeah.
I'm not optimistic, but I try to keep optimism alive. Yeah, I frequently, we get tasked with solving this problem with the traditional way of knowing, And the way the question is always asked that drives me insane is, how do we meld Western science with the traditional way of knowing? And I'm like, these two things are not at odds. We've had ecosystem-based management as a concept for decades. Science understands what's happening with climate change. The traditional way of knowing would see the change to the environment and understand that all of these things are accurate. The science is backing up the traditional way of knowing, where we really kind of miss the boat. It's not Western science, it's Western policy. The traditional way of knowing isn't some thing you need indigenous blood to really understand. It's not some spiritual tie to the land. It's just this basic concept of you look after the things that are looking after you. And it's really frustrating to be asked to meld these sciences and whatever together, but we're never asked to meld the policy. Mm-hmm. And that's really where I think we're failing, and that's why we're seeing these massive changes to a world that we've just stopped looking after.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting to think of, just that total lack of connection. There's just such a major gap between policy and the science and the indigenous way of knowing. And I think that that's also good to hear, that you don't have to have indigenous blood to know what's going on. And I think that that can be potentially used as almost an excuse or something to not be involved or not to connect or not to...
Well, and then also to push it all off on
exactly.
us. Because like, oh, hey, you've been isolated from your traditional knowledge for 100 years
yeah.
because of us. Now use what your spiritual... magical
yeah.
blood connection to the land to fix it. Like, okay, I guess we'll just go pray to the Great Spirit and
yeah.
he'll fix it for us, because that's what you've been doing wrong. Like, not praying hard enough. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No. How
yeah,
about we
absolutely.
Just start actually stewarding the territory again instead
yeah.
of extracting things from it.
Yeah, absolutely. Just shirking the blame. Yeah, that's definitely unpleasant to think of, for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's it is a difficult situation, of course. And are there any further comments or thoughts that you have on it? Or
no, I think that's all.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I feel like if you feel comfortable with kind of what you've shared, and then I think we can wrap it up here if there's anything else you...
We ended our conversation by talking about my experience in the silviculture, or tree planting, industry for 7 seasons, one of which was during the 2021 heat dome when I was working in a tree planting camp in northern British Columbia, as I tell the story of in the previous episode. We bonded over our shared distaste for modern forestry practices and concluded our conversation. Eva's insight taught me so much over the course of our roughly 30-minute conversation. This interview exemplified what I would continue to find over the course of creating this podcast, that listening and connection are integral to building a community in which we support and care for one another in crisis, and in the context of this podcast, during extreme heat events. She also noted that adaptation measures must prioritize community-based infrastructural development focused on the creation of walkable and sustainable communities, and creating through lines of communication between populations that are aware of these detrimental impacts of extreme heat events to populations that may be less informed or ignorant to the realities of extreme heat event impacts. I felt so connected to what she was saying, and it reminded me of how storytelling is a powerful way to connect and feel connected to those around us and to feel a sense of accountability to one another. Something I had not thought of before this conversation was that Indigenous ways of knowing and being are already aligned with scientific practices of land stewardship, but that Indigenous people are rarely asked to meld these teachings with policy. This gap demonstrates how important it is to learn, listen, and integrate these teachings into policies that affect real people. Eva's insight provides an opportunity for local policy and decision makers to consider this gap. How can policy be integrated into science and Indigenous ways of knowing and being that are already aligned? Without melding science, Indigenous ways of being and knowing, and policy, where does that leave us? Thank you for listening. This episode was produced by me, Erica, with the mentorship and guidance of Nicola Watts, and support from research co-leads Kirsten Ma and Dr. Sarah Marie Weeb, who shared their vision and support for this project. And funding was provided through a Michael Smith Health Research BC Reach Award. Thanks to CFUV 101.9 FM for their distribution support.